So in this particular section of the event, we're going to do a few things. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to review briefly the MILT model itself and then give you about two or three new exercises to do to really stretch your ability in MILT model so that you become a master at it at this level rather than just knowing it. Because last time around, the only exercise you really did was just writing down the MILT model patterns on a page, which doesn't really help you in delivering them like that off the cuff when you need to. That's what you're going to do here. Yes, it is quite good, isn't it? Then we're going to look at briefly intonation patterns alongside that so that you can start delivering your MILT model patterns using the intonation and inflection. I'm going to review that. And then we're going to look at the hypnotic patterns of Milton Erickson, which are outside of the MILT model. Remember, the MILT model was just work that was done by Bandler and Grinder when they modelled him that came up with the MILT model. Now we're going to look actually at the hypnotic patterns of Milton Erickson that are, you know, actually designed by him rather than someone modelling him for indirect and direct suggestion. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at those now, but not from a hypnotic point of view, at least not initially until we get to that section of the event. We're going to look at how you can utilise the indirect and direct suggestions of Milton's hypnotic patterns, but to do them in normal, everyday language. In business, for example, you can start using these in coaching. So I'm going to give you plenty of situations where you can start using them in everyday language rather than just, you know, a formal induction, which I think will make your skills more powerful. We're going to look at the structure of double binds and how we can create some exquisite double binds and then move into metaphors. And what we're going to do at metaphors level, we're going to show you and have you experience for yourself how to develop multiple nested loops so that you can start in your therapies and in your trainings, you can start having open and closed loops. So firstly, why does the MILT model work? That's the first thing. And why would you want to use it? Well, you'd want to use the MILT model to basically alter the state your client is in. Here's when I would use it. There's two times I would use MILT model patterns during my intervention with someone or my work with them. Firstly, to confuse them. That might be the first time I'd use it, is to put them into some form of confusion. Or at the end of my intervention, I would use MILT model and hypnosis to actually finish up, to end up with a positive visualization process for the client to visualize the outcome that we have agreed upon, either in coaching or therapeutically. If we go back and look at Tony's work yesterday, we can see that he did exactly that thing. Early on, he was using some language patterns to put her into confusion. For example, he did a metaphor quite early on. Remember about the gun? Remember that? And that induced confusion in her at that point. It was to teach her something to the unconscious mind and also put her into confusion. Both things happened. And then later, he did, I think twice he did this actually. Once he did it, because he had two parts of the intervention yesterday. He thought he was finished. And then he uncovered another layer, so he did it again, because he had to retrace the steps. So twice, when he'd first finished with the son and her, and then he had saw the sister's relationship and her, when his son and her, he did a closed eye process here, and then he did a second one here. The first one he did was where he had a revisit her childhood, for example, walking around Christmas presents, things like that, remember that? And the second one, obviously, he had it was the dancing around with all the family and the grandmotherly and the daughter, for example, and he had that whole visualization going on. So that's two ways he was using it, and he was interlacing with all of those things there, MILT model patterns, you know, and that means that. And whilst you're doing that, all the little things you probably didn't quite pick up yesterday, but they're all in there. Now, how do they work? They work because they're vague. They're artfully vague. And what that means is there are literally so many deletions, distortions, and generalizations in the sentence that it's not possible from just reading the sentence what somebody means by it. Because there are multiple meanings that you could make out of the sentence. So therefore, because we know, in order for the person to make sense out of what you just said, they have to make an internal representation of it. What they do is they go inside and think, oh, is it this internal representation? I'm not sure. Could it be this one? Could it be this one? And whilst they're thinking that, you put another one in. So there's so many internal representations going on inside a person's head all at one time, it puts them into a trance. And it allows you then, therefore, to start talking directly to their unconscious mind. Because whilst the conscious mind is tied up trying to work out the meaning, the unconscious mind then comes to the fore and can hear the hidden messages that you interlace in between. Now, the depth of trance that you create inside the client is as a direct proportion to the number of Milton model patterns that you use. The more that you use in a short time frame, the greater the level of trance that you'll produce in your client. The other thing that makes a big difference is the level of rapport that you have with your client. The more rapport you have, and the more Milton models, even greater depths of trance. And remember, and this is really important, and I will say it probably a number of times here, because it's my own personal experience, and that is that when your client comes in, they will be an absolute master of Milton model patterns. They just won't know that they are. So they come in, they start talking about their problem, and their problem they're talking about has got so many deletions, distortions, and generalizations in it in order for it to be a problem. Because if this is problem, okay, what's this out here? Not problem. How much bigger is not problem than problem? Massive. So therefore, in order for them to focus just on problem and delete all of this, this has to delete, distort, and generalize all of this in order for this to exist. Does that make sense? So therefore, when they start talking about it, it's really trancey. And they'll put you into such a massive loop unless you start breaking their pattern straight away. So it's important for you to recognize that, because we're going to do the same thing for them with the solution. So with the solution, what we're going to do is we're going to delete, distort, and generalize all of the problem. So we're going to reverse it, if you like, so that we put them into... Because when they come in, effectively they come in and they're in a bad trance. They don't know that they are. They basically hypnotize themselves going into a trance about their problem. Well, our job is to bring them out of trance using various techniques that we have, questioning, meta model, confusion pattern to make them confused about this, questions that create doubt about this, to bring them out. So you need to get people out of the trance. Basically then what you do is you do your change work here, and then you put them back into a trance, but you put them back into a good trance, as in a trance about the solution. So therefore in the future, they delete any problems, they delete any challenges that they have, and they only see the solution, which I think is pretty cool.
Sorry, you said a client comes in and they're in a bad trance. So it means they're actually living in a trance?
Yes.
And then you take them out of it and then put them back into one?
Yes. What you need to understand about a trance isn't that. Trance is, I'm inside. So they go inside all the time. So even when people on the out, even when there's evidence to the opposite on the outside of their problem, they can't see it. Because they're so entranced in their problem, they can't see the solution. Okay? Get the idea? How many people were in a trance with that? Because you just couldn't see the solution. It was right there in front of you, but you're so deeply entrenched in the trance. And that's what it's like for people when they're running their problem. When they're running their problem, they're running their pattern. And so many people in that game run their pattern. You see it happening. They're like doing this, doing that, going inside, doing the, I'm not good enough, I'm going to be the last one standing, why is he doing this, why is he making me feel this way? Why is he hurting me, why is he making me stand out and look stupid? Running all of their stuff, rather than just going, oh, it's okay. Because whilst they're doing all of that, they can't find the answer, because they're in that bad trance.
Thank you. Hi, Steve from Team 2. Just think, on the trance bit, yesterday when you were chunking up Kida, yes. I was confused because twice I thought you'd be stopping once you got to a need. And you went beyond that and kept going beyond that, and twice. And so I was getting confused. When do you know when you've... Well, it's great to be confused, but when do you know when you've gone beyond that and need to stop and can stop?
Good. To unpack that one yesterday, what I was looking for when I was trying... We started with control. So your question is, where do I stop with where I find it, yes? Yeah. I wasn't looking for that. What I was looking for, the non-mirror image reverse of control, is what I was looking for. I was looking for her to see the not problem in this. Because what she does is, effectively, if that's the problem, I'm saying anything less than control, it's like a double negative, anything less than total control isn't freedom. And they come outside the boundary. And then you go, isn't it? And put them back in. And they do it again. Back in. And back in. So ultimately what happens is the boundary here starts to collapse. The more you keep crossing the threshold of the boundary, going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, it collapses the boundary. We didn't get there yesterday. That's where I was going yesterday with that intervention. Make sense? Yeah. We're going to cover that a bit later anyway in more depth. So let's have a look at the Milton model patterns. Let's have a go through them. Let me give you a few examples that are there in your page. We'll have to have a look at that. Mind reading. What we're doing here is you start saying words and things that you don't know. So at this point, we're actually mind reading is okay at this point. You claim in your sentence to know the thoughts or feelings of another person without specifying the process by which you came to know the information. So our example there is, I know you think I'm wondering. Now, there's no way that the person at this point in that sentence can know that you're wondering. So what the person does inside, basically they go like, how does he know that? Yeah, and they go inside. And then what you do is you fire off another one. So let's have a look at lost performative. Don't get lost with the names of these things, by the way. It doesn't really matter. Lost performative means the person saying it, we don't know who they are. The performer of the judgment, we don't know who the performer is. We don't know who said the statement. So the value judgment's where the performer of the value judgment is left out. So we say, and it's excellent that you are. But we don't know who's saying that it's excellent. Who says it's excellent? It doesn't say. It just says, and it's excellent. But we don't know who's saying it's excellent. Cause and effect. Well, there you go. It's easy enough. Where it's implied that one thing causes another. Implied causatives include cause and effect with the word makes or because. If X, then Y. As you X, then you Y. Because if you continue that you are learning many things. Yeah. So we've linked because, as in, and it's excellent that you are, because if you continue that you are learning many things. Now, does it mean that if you're excellent that you're, and if you continue that you're learning many things? Does that make sense? It doesn't necessarily make sense, does it? But it's plausible. It's a plausible sentence. That's all it takes. Now remember here, we're taking all these things in mini isolation here. So it won't necessarily, in isolation, these things don't seem to have any real impact at all. So most people, when they start doing this stuff, go like, yeah, so what? And it doesn't really mean anything until you put it all together. So complex equivalence. Where two things are equated as in their meaning being the same or equivalent. So we're looking for the verbs to be, as in I am, they are, he is, people are. So our sentence is, after all, life is learning, and learning is life. Meaning, all those things are the same, they're equated as one. Now that can be very powerful when you're linking one thing to another that doesn't necessarily be linked. But you can link a solution, for example, to just one thing the person's done. So every time you breathe, that means you're learning even more, or you're going even deeper, or every time you take a breath, that means you're solving this every time. Something like, doesn't mean that, but if the person accepts that as a suggestion, they will activate it, they'll act upon it. Okay, presuppositions, that's any of the previous presuppositions at all. So basically any sentence with linguistic equivalent of assumptions in it. So, and it won't be the first or the last time. What's that a presupposition of, by the way? Ordinal, yes. First or last. Ordinal. Yes, and it won't be the first or the last time. So it presupposes that there's things that have gone before and there were things that come after. Okay. Universal quantifiers. A set of words which have the following characteristics. Universal generalization. So it's going to have huge general. This is going to be a huge generalization. And no referential index, meaning that there is no reference to what you're saying to actually give facts to it. So, as everyone is learning everything all the time, never not. It's quite good, isn't it? So we've got everyone, we've got everything, we've got all, we've got never. All of those are generalizations of those words. So what the person does is it expands their thinking completely. They have to expand their mind to accept the sentence, and it really expands it. And we have modal operators, words which imply possibility or necessity, and which form our rules in life. So it's not impossible to find that you can. Some really good use of negation there as well. It's not impossible to find that you can. Other words we could use. What other words could be used that are modal operators? Give me one or two, shout them out. Should, yeah. So therefore shouldn't as well. Want, can, can't, must, mustn't. Need, need not. Allowed, yes. So any kind of words that have rule base to them, yes. Have to. Okay, nominalizations. Now, this is a tricky one. This is the one a lot of people get stuck on, and a lot of people maybe got stuck on this last time, so let's take some care and attention to nominalizations. Now, these are basically process words, as in verbs, doing words, which have been frozen in time by making them into nouns or making them sound like they're nouns. So they sound like they're a thing with form, like you could touch it almost. By the way the sentence is delivered, it looks like it should be a thing, but it's actually not a thing at all. It's actually a process. It's a doing. So here we got create deep understandings, new integrations, and profound insights. So deep understandings, new integrations and insights sound like they're things, because it actually says create. Creating them, as in like they're things that exist. They don't exist, they're processes. Yeah. So they are very trancy because the person, and they're also, from a bad point of view, they're trancy as well, because if a doctor, for example, gives you a nominalization, as in you have cancer, or you have hypertension, or you have diabetes, what happens is you go into a trance and you accept the suggestion, and it's very stuck. There's nothing you can do about it. It's a very stuck state to be in. It's very different when if a doctor says you're currently cancering yourself. What difference does it make? Just try it on. You have cancer, you are cancering, you're currently cancering yourself. What's the difference between those two things inside your nervous system? What happens? Cause and effect, yes. One's something you can do something about, and the other one, you're stuffed, basically. You have it. What about the energy? Think about the energy in the words. You have cancer. You are currently cancering yourself. What's the difference in energy? Heavy in the body. Stuck. Yeah. negative energy. Yeah, it's like a, like it stops immediately. It's like there's a the energy disappears. Whereas you are currently cancering, it's moving, isn't it? You see, which is what you want. You want the problem to be moving, not stuck. So the hell, what the worst thing a doctor could ever say to you is you have X. Because then the person has a ready-made excuse. It's not their fault. They can't do anything about it. I need outside help. So I need something else to help me rather than from within. And that whole feeling like that feeling is what creates fear of death like that instantaneously, or creates the fear of that I have this thing, and that itself can generate and create the thing itself anyway. So always when you're communicating with people, it's the same thing with like, I have depression. It's the same thing. I have depression. Or I am depressed. What is it? I am depressed. What kind of language pattern is that? It's a complex equivalent. I and depressed are equated as being the same. I am depressed. That's a complex equivalent, isn't it? Yeah? So again, puts the person into a trance. I am, they go into their bad trance about their problem, like I just said, because they will be using that language pattern. Do you get the idea now? See, they're using a Milton model pattern because they're in that trance about it, but they can't see it. So what you say, if someone says, I am depressed, one of the things you would say straight away is, oh, I see. So how are you depressing yourself? Or how are you choosing to depress yourself? Or how are you depressing yourself? Turns it back into a process, makes it start moving again, puts them at cause. Are they going to butt up against you? Yes. Are they going to hear you? No. They're not even going to hear you say it. You're going to say, how are you depressing yourself? They're going to go, so what did he say? Because you're just going to bring them outside the thing for a moment and don't even hear you at this point. Yeah. Good. So nominalizations, basically process words that appear to be masquerading as nouns, but they're not nouns at all. The way you know that they're not a noun is in your mind. A noun is a thing, which means if it's a thing, you can put it in the wheelbarrow. So if it's a proper noun, a person, Andy, you can make a picture of Andy being in a wheelbarrow and it works. But you can't put deep understandings in a wheelbarrow. It doesn't work. You can't see it. So that's how you know if it's not working or not. Make sense? One second. My microphone coming.
Thanks. I'm Rosemary in Team 2. Just a moment ago, you said that if you said to somebody, if your response to I'm depressed is, how are you depressing yourself? And you said they'd wrinkle their foreheads and say, well, what was that you said? Mm. Would you, at that moment, come up with another confusing, or would you come up with something different and confusing, or would you repeat the same one?
You could repeat the same one.
Yeah.
Or you could fire off a linguistic presuppositional language pattern.
Okay.
Because ideally, all you want to do at this point is get the problem moving at that point. Yeah? Because they're stuck in the trance, and all you're doing is more and more. What you're effectively doing is taking them out of their trance and putting them into your trance. Because they're in their trance, which you can't influence. Once they're if they're stuck in their trance, you can't get them out. There's a famous story of Erikson and Bandler, and you couldn't be around Erikson and not be in a trance because he was an absolute master at it. So all that Bandler did was put himself into a deep trance before he went in to see him, and then Erikson couldn't trance him because he was already in a bad trance. He was already in a trance already, and that's what your clients do. Your clients are so already in a trance already, you can't influence them because they can't hear you. They're so much in their own trance, they just can't get access to it at that point. And that's what we experienced yesterday, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah? Thanks.
So you can fire anything off to confusing language, but just to, whatever you do, make sure whatever you do keeps it moving.
Thanks
that's
very
the key.
Much, Andy.
Yeah.
Andy, how do you know when someone isn't in a trance?
How do you know when somebody isn't in a trance? They're dead.
Okay, fine, yeah.
Okay. Unspecified verbs. Just simply, you're saying a verb, but you're giving no detail to the verb at all. So our example there, just because you can. Can what? You don't know. Can what? Can do anything. You don't know. So the person has to go like, can what? They don't actually say to themselves, can what? They never get as far as saying the language in their head. Inside themselves, it just feels trancey because they can't figure it out. And it doesn't tie in with anything else. We don't really know what it means. Okay, tag question. tag question. A question added after a statement designed to displace resistance. Because, you know, when you ask somebody, when you say something to someone, they always have the ability to reject what you just asked them or suggested it. So if you put a tag question on the end, what happens is they focus on the tag bit at the end rather than the bit that just gone before it. So in this case, can't you? Or it could be, wouldn't you? Haven't you? Won't you? And if you're doing some quantum linguistic patterns, you can say one that doesn't actually make sense. You can say, so you'll do that in the future, haven't you? So that doesn't make sense, unless you're seeking to actually move them from here in their mind to over there. Because what does haven't you say? So you'll be doing that in the future, haven't you? What does that do? It propels them into the future. It propels them into the future, looking back at what they have done in the future. Does that make sense? Now, that's quite clever. I'm going to get to that when we start doing verb tenses. But ideally, at this point, you're just looking to basically draw attention to the end of the statement rather than the statement itself. So you've got haven't you, isn't it, mustn't you, didn't you, won't you, things like that.
If you said to someone, you said you'd, put the rubbish out in the bin, didn't mm-hmm. you? I think you'd create resistance to them. In them. So
ask me that question again.
If you said to someone, you said you put the rubbish out, didn't you? Then I think you create resistance in them. So.
That statement like that, yes. But if we look at the statement here, which is, if we take the whole sentence, like, you create deep understandings, new integrations, and profound insights just because you can, can't you?
Okay.
Yeah, that's more like it, because what you're doing is you're just giving two options. So you can, can't you? That's what we're looking for, is the both options. So you can, can't you? So you could put the rubbish out, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You can put the rubbish out, can't you? Yeah.
Sure.
So can and can't. So they're tied up in a loop there between both options being available. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
So your first sentence, you were correct. But this sentence, you want a positive and the opposite of that in the same sentence. Yeah.
Thank you.
Makes sense? Okay, lack of referential index. Again, one of these flashy old statements. A phrase which does not pick out a specific portion of the listener's experience. Basically, when you say it, it just basically means we don't really know who the sentence applies to. So in this case, everybody can, nobody can't. So they sound a bit like a universal quantifier, but they don't have to be. Okay? They wouldn't necessarily, you could use some other words, wouldn't necessarily be. You could have people. You could say, so people can. So people is not a universal quantifier, but people is universal, as in there's a lack of referential. We know people can, like which people? It's too vague. Or you could say one, not the queen, one. And the queen uses milk model patterns, doesn't she? Yeah? Yes, does one do this? Does one do that? Yes. Or they, you could say they. Who is the group called they? We don't know. There's no reference, there's no referential index. The group is too big. So it's a big generalization. Okay, moving on to comparative deletions, where the comparison is made and it is not specified as to what or whom it is made. So, that's the major difference between learning this way. Now, I've actually crossed out it's much easier, because it could be argued that that's actually giving you the comparison. It's not, but it could be argued. So that's the major difference between learning this way. It's much easier. Okay, but we're not really comparing one thing with another. So what you're doing with a comparative deletion is you compare something. It's better. It's more. but you don't tell them what it's better than or what it's more than. You just give half the sentence. And again, because it's not complete, because there's a massive deletion in the sentence, it's trancy. Okay, pacing current experience. Well, this is fairly simple. All we're doing, and this is pretty much what Erickson does or did with most of his clients, because it's just pure utilization, where the client's experience, verifiable external experience, is described in a way which is undeniable. So as you continue listening, following the examples, breathing, blinking, and thinking through the ideas. Now the person's going to be listening, they're going to be following the examples, and they're going to be breathing and blinking and thinking through the ideas since they're there with you. So you can link these things in. Now, here's how that works quite well. What you can do is you can graduate those suggestions. So what the way I would use it is, you start off with things that are undeniable and move them to things that are actually slightly deniable, to things that could certainly be deniable. But if you yes set it, if you get them into a yes set, like you're sitting there, you're listening to me, you're looking at me, you're listening to the sound of my voice, and you can feel your breathing in and out. And that means you're learning all about Milton model patterns at the deepest level. Didn't you? Yep. So what you do is you all these things, you go, yep, 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 yep. And the bit where you're going to go, not sure, you just go, yep, because you're in a yes set. Make sense? Okay, double binds. This is basically the exclusive or club. You can also have reverse set double binds as well. We'll talk about that in a little while. Wherein the illusion of choice is offered using an or. However, usually both choices are desired, as in desired by you, the person that's delivering them. So, here we go. I think there's a couple of those in here. You are learning at the level of your deeply unconscious, not necessarily the conscious. And that means you have already learned much more about conversational change than you thought you had. Haven't you? If you want to put a little tech question on the end as well. So that's an exclusive or, because you're learning at the level of your deeply unconscious, not necessarily the conscious. But what that's an exclusive or club is that you're learning. Yes? It doesn't say how, it just says that you're learning at either one of these two ways, but you are learning, either consciously or unconsciously. And then we've got, and that means, so we've got a nice little complex equivalent shoved in as well, and that means you have already learned much more about conversational potential change than you thought you had. Okay, conversational postulate. Basically, this is a closed question. It's a closed question. Which basically means, closed question means they can say yes or no to it. But what you're doing, the reason we're saying conversational posture is this. You could make a statement, but rather than make a statement, which can more resisted, you ask it in, rather turn your statement into a question. Now, this is something you want to definitely apply in sales. All of these things here can apply in sales. My salespeople use these all the time in our sales presentations. Because in sales, here's what you need to learn to do. Most people think in sales that you need to have the gift of the gab. Bollocks. You definitely don't want that. You want to have the skill and the art of asking questions. That's what makes you powerful as a salesperson. So you want to learn to turn your statements into questions. So, in this case, the communication has the form of a question to which the response is either a yes or a no. If I want you to do something, what else must be present so that you will do it? And out of your awareness, it allows you to choose to respond or not and avoids authoritarianism. So, of course, a lot of people, there's a lot of people, including people in the room, whose metaprogram is mismatching. That's okay. That's very useful in certain situations. It does limit you in certain situations as well, but it's also useful. But when it gets a little bit out of control, as in they're using it because it's a control thing, because they need to have control, then what you do is when people, you're working with people who are like that, then they become very resistant. So you need to use their resistance to help them, to guide them into a deeper level of trance. So you can say, I mean, do you already know you can use this? Rather than saying to them, look, you can use this, which they could easily say no to. But if you say, I mean, do you already know you can use this? See, that puts them back at cause. They have to choose yes or no. And they're probably going to say yes at this point in their mind, because they don't want to think that they can't use it. So that's how it works. 16, extended quotes. Oh, who's seen the Harry Potter movie? Recent one, the new one. Who remembers the bit where they're in the woods and Hermione Granger is giving Harry Potter a message from, she's giving it from Ron? Remember? Massive extended quote. She comes in and says, something on the lines of, Ron says that Hagrid says, and there's a big long quote, and Harry Potter goes, what? She went, oh, don't ask me to do it again. Because it's a long extended quote. And then later on, when he's speaking to Ron, later when they've sort of made friends again, he said, I told you about so-and-so. Because Hermione told you that. He went, nobody could have ever worked out what was going on with that statement. And I thought, brilliant. So if now you watch the film again, you'll see there's a long extended quote there. So the idea behind an extended quote is this. If you want the client to accept a suggestion that you know they might be heavily resistant to, what you do is you make it that somebody else is saying it to somebody else rather than saying it to you. Make sense? So it's kind of embedded in this whole story, this little mini story has an embedded suggestion in it, but the other person doesn't realize it. But if they accept the story, they will accept the suggestion embedded within it. That's what an extended quote's for, just so we're clear. So where it's not possible for one to tell, oh, that's already, we're doing a Milton model in a minute, middle of that already, aren't we, for one? It's not impossible for one to tell where one quote leaves off and the next one begins. One of my students used conversational chains so exquisitely with his staff, they thought he was a wizard. They come in and tell him the problem, and moments later it had gone. His boss spoke to him. They asked, how do you do that? Go see David Shepherd, he said. Yeah? So what you want is go see David Shepherd, make sense? Or go see Andy Harrington. But what you've actually got there is it's hidden within the story, so you don't know what's going on. Great. Selectional restrictional violation. A long phrase. What does it mean? It just basically means a sentence that's not well formed in that only humans and animals can have feelings, as far as we know anyway. So, you see, even a conversational change technique has the power to change what a company's budget dictates. So we're saying that conversational change has power. It can't have power. It's not a human. It's a process. It's a thing. And what a company budget dictates. Now, do budgets dictate? Can a budget dictate? It can't, can it? It's a budget. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't speak. It's just a bit of paper. Yeah? Something written down on a paper. Okay, and ambiguities. Split up into a few different sections. Ambiguities, we have phonological, where two words with different meanings sound alike. Open your ears so you can truly hear what I'm saying here with your unconscious nose. Good, isn't it? Very trancy. Okay, let's have a look at syntactical. So that's phonological, where words sound the same. Now we'll look at syntactical, where the function, stroke syntactic, of a word, as in what the word means, can't be immediately determined from the sentence. So, that hypnotizing hypnotists can be fun. and selling salespeople easy. So we don't know whether we're saying that hypnotizing hypnotists, as in somebody hypnotizing a hypnotist, or hypnotists that are hypnotizing, we don't know what they mean. And we don't know whether selling salespeople, as in selling something to a salesperson, is easy, or whether people that are salespeople that are selling is easy. You don't know. You can't work it out from the sentence. Scope ambiguity, where it cannot be determined from linguistic context how much is applied to the sentence by some other portion of the sentence. So this is normally where we see lots of ands in the sentence, and we don't know whether to apply the and to the first part of the sentence or the second part. So, speaking to you as someone who has already learnt many conversational change techniques, you can already put away the old ideas and constructs and silence the disturbing noises and thoughts. It's very trancing. So, speaking to you as someone who has already learnt many conversational change techniques, am I saying you are someone who have already learnt many conversational change techniques, or am I saying I am somebody who has already learnt many conversational change techniques? You don't know. It's vague, ambiguous from the language. And also, you can already put away the old ideas and constructs and silence the disturbing thoughts. So, are we asking you to put away old ideas, constructs, and silence the disturbing thoughts? Are we asking you to put away the silence? Or are we asking you, in addition to putting away the old ideas and constructs, are we also asking you, in addition to that, to silence disturbing noise and thoughts? Or asking you to put them away? You don't know, because the word and makes it ambiguous. Okay, and punctuation ambiguity is a run-on sentence. I want you to notice your hand in other people's learning and transformation. Now, the way to deliver that sentence to make it work better is when you get to the end of the first part is change your tonality slightly. Listen. I want you to notice your hand in other people's learning and transformation. So it is lower, slower, deeper. I want you to notice your hand in other people's learning and transformation. Very trancy. Or you could pause at improper places. Just keep pausing at times where it doesn't really have any real reason why you would be pausing it. Or you could do incomplete sentences. The sentence where it doesn't actually get finished at all. Just finish the sentence without actually finishing it. Very trancy. Our example there, I mean, just think of, and then just carry on with something else instead of that. Good. Utilization. Finally, utilization. Basically, utilizing anything the client says. That's very, very important in your career as an NLP practitioner. You always want to be utilizing what the person uses. So rather than fight it and object it, rather than butting it, what you do is you just utilize it. The client says, I'm not sold. And you say, that's right. You are not sold. Yet. And that's because you haven't asked me the one question about our training program that will have you totally want to go ahead and book it now. So what would you like to ask me? Now, if they ask you a question next and you answer it, they're sold. You're done. Here's an even more eloquent one that I came up with recently. I'm not sold. And you say, that's right. You are far too valuable a commodity to be sold. You and I both know the only way you'll buy this is if you are a good enough salesperson to sell it to yourself. Won't you? Yeah. You like that one? It's good, isn't it? Huh? Yep. So, so they say, I'm not sold. And use a bit of an ambiguity as well by saying, that's right. You're not sold. Because you are far too valuable a commodity to be sold. As in, no one could sell you because you're priceless. That's kind of what you're saying. That's really utilizing them, meeting them where they're at, making them feel good. And then you carry on. Say, you and I both know, mind read, the only way, exclusive or, the only way you'll buy this embedded command is, complex equivalent, if you are a good enough salesperson to sell it to yourself, embedded command. That will definitely fry somebody's circuits, if you say that. And then you would follow that up, really. So you would say, okay, see, I'm not sold yet. Say, okay, good, I understand, you're right. And that's because you are far too valuable a commodity to be sold. Because you and I both know the only way you'll buy this is if you are a good enough salesperson to sell it to yourself, won't you? And they say, yes. And then you say, so what is it about our program that you like that has you know this is the right thing for you? The moment they answer that question, they've sold it to themselves. The last bit, yes. So you would say to them, so what is it about our program or product or whatever that has you know this is the right thing for you? If they answer that question, you're done. Whatever they say, you just agree with it. They say, oh, I suppose what I really, really like is I like the fact you do this, you do that. You say, that's right. And you might then say to them, and what else? You say this and that. You say, So as you think about it now, can you see how this is the right thing for you? Yeah? Again, displacing it, can you see how this is the right thing for you? Displacing resistance. Now, even they get in any affirmative, like, yeah, okay, good. So, have you sold it to yourself now? Are you ready to sell this to yourself now? Are you ready to commit yourself to this now? Something like that. Closing question. And you're done.